loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is facing the wrath of his own party following the government shutdown. Progressive Democrats are upset that Schumer won almost nothing tangible in exchange for providing the votes to pass a continuing resolution, largely seen as a victory for President Trump. Next, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said yesterday that Turkey's offensive against Syria is disrupting efforts to finish off ISIS. French President Macron, meanwhile, criticized Turkey's human rights record in Syria. Then the Trump administration announced harsh new tariffs of as high as 50% on solar panels and washing machines, angering China and South Korea, where they're manufactured. Observers say these are only the first of Donald Trump's America First tariffs. And then Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is a giant in Brazilian politics, but the former president is at a crossroads. He could finish this year in prison, serving a 9.5-year sentence for corruption, or once again, he could find himself as president of Brazil. And last today, we begin a new weekly segment where we take a look at the economic direction of the country. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to fallout over the government shutdown. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is facing the wrath of his own party following the shutdown. Progressive Democrats are upset that Schumer won almost nothing tangible in exchange for providing the votes to pass a continuing resolution, largely seen as a victory for President Trump. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. And you can find his writings at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the early polls, Dave, show that among Democrats, they believe that they lost this standoff with Donald Trump, and they're blaming Chuck Schumer. Do you think that that's a serious concern? Is it something that Schumer ought to be worried about as the Democrats start looking down to the next showdown in February?
I don't know whether Schumer has to worry. I mean, it seems like the Schumer middle of the road establishment, pro Wall Street gang in the Democratic Party have kind of a lock on the party. It's more that I think there have been two losers here. The Democratic Party is the loser because they're showing themselves unable to get past the fact that a minority of their members who are senators and also members of Congress in red states are unwilling to take hard stands on progressive issues. And that means that even though they're 51-49 in the Senate, which is a pretty damn big opposition numerically, they can't really do anything like shut down the government. So that they're losers in the sense that they've been exposed as incredibly weak despite their numbers. And then on the Republican side, I think this is a big loss for the Republicans long term because they're alienating the fastest growing population group in the United States, which is Latinos.
Yeah. And regarding the Democrats, even we have Doug Jones meeting with Trump now. I mean, this was supposedly the Democratic Party's revival, and it's going to be something really important. And Doug Jones won the Senate race in Alabama. So then... and he defeated Roy Moore, and all of the progressives and the leftists were so excited about Doug Jones. And here's Doug Jones really basically voting with Trump and the Republicans. And that's just the way this will work out over
Absolutely.
And over and over again. It's not just Doug Jones, it's Joe Manchin.
Sure.
But even a lot of other people who were not necessarily red state Democrats. But I think the Democrats felt, the Dreamers, the position in the case of the Dreamers is very popular in the country. By far, like 80% of the people in the country, according to the polling, support the Dreamers and want relief for the Dreamers and do not want these million people to be deported. And most people also consider the building of a wall at the U.S.-Mexican border to be unpopular. And at the very same weekend where you had literally, I don't know, millions of people out in demonstrations at the Women's March. The constellation of forces within and between the two parties is such that Donald Trump promoting an unpopular position, the Mexican border wall, triumphed over the Democrats who were supporting something that was popular, the Dream Act. I mean, it shows that within the, to me, within the current constellation of American politics, the left and for the left and those who aspire to create progressive change, this is fundamentally a dead end. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. The Democrats have proven once again that they are not an opposition party, really, that they're part of the system, and that there's no place for progressives in the party in terms of trying to get anything really significant done. It is a it's a party of compromise and of, you know, caving in, and has been for years. And this was a classic example. They cannot take a solid progressive position and make it stick with their members.
Dave, I'm looking at an op-ed in today's New York Times, and it is written by Michelle Goldberg. And she says here, it's hard to overstate how disgusted many progressive leaders are with Schumer. It's Senator Schumer's job as minority leader to keep his caucus together and stand up for progressive values. And he failed to do that, says Ezra Levin, a co-founder of Indivisible, a left-wing advocacy group modeled on the Tea Party. He led them off a cliff and then he caved. And it's not just pressure people who are saying this. Representative Luis Gutierrez, a Democrat of Illinois, said in a statement, "This shows me that when it comes to immigrants, Latinos and their families, Democrats are still not willing to go to the mat." With that said, McConnell told Schumer that he would allow floor debate on DACA and immigration reform. That is not to say that Paul Ryan has to allow debate and a vote on DACA and immigration reform. Did the Democrats end up getting literally nothing for their vote to allow a continuing resolution, or am I missing something here?
Oh, no, you're right. They got nothing because they have to win in both houses. And clearly, the House is not going to support immigration reform. There's too many people in, you know, on the far conservative side in the House that will simply, they just consider the DACA people to be illegal immigrants and that want to take a really hard line. So the all that they'll get is a debate. And whether it'll even come up in the House is a question, because Ryan has pretty much made it clear that he doesn't want to bring bills up that don't have the support of the majority of his Republicans in the House.
The big losers here really are the immigrant.
Without a doubt.
I mean, it's not really even Schumer. Yes, the Democrats are exposed in that sense. So they're losers because the veneer is off. But let's just go back and show and talk about how diabolical this whole thing is. Obama passed the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, meaning children who came when their parents came to this country without legal papers should not be deported. It didn't mean that they necessarily had a pathway to citizenship. They just weren't going to be deported.
No, and it's not amnesty in any sense of the word.
But they could go to school. They could get a job. They could get a driver's license, perhaps. Trump comes in, and for no real reason except to appease his xenophobic base, strips those people of those protections, these million young people. And then the Democrats try to feebly restore the status that had been adopted for the Dreamers, and then they're unable to do it. And there's no reason to think at all that Trump, who doesn't care about anything except Trump, and certainly has been appeasing his base with all of these gratuitous attacks on immigrant populations, that he's going to turn around and do something wonderful so that the Democrats can at least go away saying, okay, it didn't happen all at once, but ultimately our perseverance gave the Dreamers relief. I don't necessarily see that happening unless masses of people come into the streets during the next 17 days. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. The only thing that will change this is if the leadership in the Republican Party sees this as a disaster for them over the next 10 years, you know, where they have to think about could Texas go leave the Republican Party because of the number of Latinos in the population and other states in the Southwest, Colorado, all the states that are have rapidly growing Latino populations that have been reliably Republican. If they look at that map and say, oh, geez, we can't be so alienating, take more of the George Bush position on Latinos, then, unless they get that feeling, they're not going to do anything for these 800,000 or 900,000 people who can't vote.
I'm looking at two tweets that Donald Trump wrote this morning. One says, even crazy Jim Acosta of fake news CNN agrees. Trump world and White House sources dancing in end zone. Trump wins again. Schumer and Dems caved, gambled and lost. He says, thank you for your honesty, Jim. And then he later tweeted, big win for Republicans as Democrats cave on shutdown. Now I want a big win for everyone, including Republicans, Democrats and DACA, but especially for our great military and border security. Should be able to get there. See you at the negotiating table. Are we really going to see these different sides at the negotiating table? We know that that the Republicans in the House have no interest in immigration reform. Go ahead. We have 1 minute left.
Well, they played the Democrats really well because they claimed, these poor military guys weren't getting their paychecks abroad. But of course, military guys abroad in Syria and Afghanistan don't use money anyway. I mean, they're like getting their meals provided and their housing. They don't need their paychecks. So the Democrats need to be able to stand up and say that's, it's just not an issue. But they can't. They can't say anything that might offend the military.
No, it's the sacred cow these days. I'm sorry that our time is up. Dave Lindorf joined us from Philadelphia. He's an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. And you can find his very interesting writings at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said yesterday that Turkey's offensive against Syria is disrupting efforts to finish off ISIS. French President Macron, meanwhile, criticized Turkey's human rights record in Syria. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Masoud, explain to our listeners what exactly we're looking at in Syria right now. You've got the Syrians, of course. You have Syrian Kurds, Russians, Turks, Americans. It's a mix that seems to be very volatile and dangerous.
Yeah, it's really extremely puzzling. I mean, here Turkey, a NATO ally, is sort of going against allies of United States, another NATO ally. And it seems that sort of both sides are supporting and fighting against the Kurdish element and trying to actually sort of take this sort of border, control of this border. The Turkey is saying that they want to control something region of 30 kilometers deep within their border. And Americans are saying that they want the Kurdish to actually control that area. And both sides sort of agree that the Kurdish have got elements within it which are recognized by both America and the Turkish government as being sort of terrorist group, PKK. And, it really is a mess. But if you go a bit deeper into it, you realize that what Turkey is actually asking for is something that they've been asking for a very long time under the different sort of excuses. If you remember, it wasn't, just around a year ago, Turkey came up with this plan that they want to have a sort of safe zone within the border. So they will basically control it. It will be no fly zone, and it will be an enclave that the opposition of Assad will be sort of using to sort of control. And in reality, it means that undermining the integrity of Syrian territories. And what Americans are asking is a similar thing, but different players, again, undermining the integrity of the Syrian territory. And it really has got nothing to do with fighting Daesh, because Daesh has been around for a very long time. And if it wasn't for the efforts of Syria, Russians, and Iran and Hezbollah, the Daesh would be not only sort of very prominent in Syria, would have been very prominent in Iraq.
Yes, indeed. I mean, here we have a situation where the United States is partnering with the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, mainly Kurdish forces, the YPG, who Erdogan, a U.S. ally in the eastern flank of NATO, identifies as nothing other than an extension of the PKK, the Workers' Party of Kurdistan in Turkey, which the Turks consider to be a terrorist organization. And they have waged an ongoing war against any semblance of Kurdish autonomy or independence. And of course, the largest Kurdish population in among those four countries is in Turkey. So you hear here we have a clash. U.S. and Turkey are allies in NATO. U.S. and Kurds are allies in northern Syria, which Turkey considers to be something of an existential threat, because they believe it will, if an autonomous area is developed for the Kurds, that it'll be a catalyst for the same kind of phenomena within Turkey. It seems in a way, Masoud, like an intractable problem. Of course, the Turks don't want to have a military engagement with the Americans. I don't think they're looking for that. But if they continue their push, say, east of the Euphrates, past Afrin and past Azaz, is it possible that there would be that kind of a clash?
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, there is really... you know, we should also not forget the sort of the Kurds in Iraq. I mean, we had the crisis or the sort of vote for independence, and Turkey responded very aggressively to it. And then indeed, you know, all the regional sort of neighbors were finding it very unacceptable. And there you again have got a U.S. and Israeli support for the Kurds in Iraq. I think there are some fundamental deep problem. Turkey, for a very long time, has failed to deal with its Kurdish population. And around sort of 3-4 years ago, decided to actually resolve its Kurdish so-called situation or problem through military means, and started sort of attacking the Kurdish areas within Turkey and then spreading over into Iraq and elsewhere. And so, you know, there is this sort of militarized relationship between Turkey and its own Kurdish, which are sort of identified themselves with the wider Kurdish community, which is partly in Syria, partly in Iraq, and they etc. And I think that is actually one of the problems. Until Turkey comes to recognize that the Kurdish population of its own Kurdish population are part and parcel of their citizenship and has to be dealt with politically rather than militarily, we're going to have this problem. But this problem is now being split into sort of arena that the United States is heavily arming and supporting militarily the Kurdish community, both in Syria and in Iraq, and politically. And that is actually creating a problem, because, you know, it's creating a support for an entity which Turkey is in war with.
That's really the bottom line here. Turkey sees the YPG as just an extension across the border of the PKK. And we know how Turkey views the PKK. They have worked to crush the PKK for decades now. And at the same time, the U.S. is on this trajectory where it is going to clash with the government of Turkey unless it, you know, veers away from the policy.
Yeah, because the U.S. doesn't have, they don't have boots on the ground in sufficient number to be a factor.
That's right.
The only boots on the ground that they can really rely on are the Kurdish boots on the ground. Now, the Kurds, I'm not making the argument that the Kurds are a puppet of the United States. The Kurds are a people. They have their own ethnicity, their own language, a long, rich cultural tradition. They also were deprived of statehood and nationhood by the Sykes-Picot Treaty at the end of World War One. They were they certainly would have been a viable state because they had contiguous territory with a people with a common language, common religion, common culture. They have been deprived of these basic rights and turned into a minority in Syria, in Turkey, in Iran, in Iraq. They've been reduced to minority status as a consequence of colonialism. Let's just call it what it is.
They've been oppressed.
So the Kurds have a legitimate and do have legitimate grievances that are not easily remediable and given the current constellation of forces. But at the same time, big picture, Syria is a sovereign country, and Turkey does not have the right to be in Syria. America does not have the right, no matter what they say about Kurdish autonomy or the rights of Kurds or the noble goals that they have for the Kurds. They have no right to be in Syria. They're not invited in by Syria. And as a consequence, we have illegality both from Turkey and from the United States penetrating Syria. And as a consequence, the war, which could, I think, Masoud, tell me your opinion, I think this war could be virtually over if it wasn't for the intervention of the Turks and the Americans at this point.
Absolutely. I think the reality is that there is a legitimate aspiration of the Kurds, which has been undermined, and probably more so in Turkey than anywhere else. And there was a time around the sort of 7-10 years ago, that we saw a different approach by Turkey towards the Kurdish population. And, we were looking forward to see some sort of political resolution and settlement to the issue. They are aspiration. They are a very genuine aspiration from Kurds that they want to use their own language, their own culture, and preserve it. And they should have the right to do that. And those aspirations are totally undermined by Turkey. Not in the same way in Iran, they have those aspirations realized to some more or less extent. But the fact that this has been undermined have created an environment where others have actually tried to take advantage of it. And there are others who have actually come in and seeing that, by pumping up the Kurdish elements and certain elements who are indeed are not just looking for certain legitimate accommodation, but they're going far beyond that. And those elements are being strengthened by the behavior of Turkey towards its court and indeed the rest of the Kurdish population in the area. So really these environments have been created and there are people manipulating it. United States is manipulating it, Israel is manipulating it, and Turkey is failing to address it in a realistic way and then find the political solution, which indeed is the only way to find the solution to it. So, and then in because of the chaos in Syria, they feel that they could actually not only manipulate it in their own country, they could actually go across the border and start attacking people, which at the end of the day is going to create a huge number of further suffering for the ordinary civilians in the area, and it's going to harden them.
It's only going to get worse. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Masoud, we're joined from London by Masoud Shajada. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Donald Trump's America First policy has plunged the U.S. into a possible trade war both with Mexico and with China. We are joined from Chiapas, Mexico by Baldomar Velasquez. He is the president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, or FLOC. And we are joined from New York City by Pete Dolak. He is an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro, who focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. And he's the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. Baldomar Velasquez, you're in Chiapas. Let's talk about NAFTA and what it's meant for workers in the United States, what it's meant for workers and peasants and farmers and indigenous populations in Mexico, and where you are in Chiapas, where, of course, in January 1st, 1994, the Zapatistas began their armed uprising in what they called a protest against NAFTA because they proclaimed that it would be a death sentence for indigenous people. Go ahead.
Well, it's been a disaster in the rural countryside in Mexico, along with the agriculture sector in the United States. From our point of view, I can't comment on the other aspects of NAFTA, but this particular issue is very key and important to the work that we've done for many years. The NAFTA agreement pretty much has displaced millions of peasant farmers in Mexico, because when you integrate markets with no tariffs on the border, North American agriculture is very highly mechanized and highly subsidized. Remember, our farm bill is one of the big holy grails of agriculture, and Mexican farmers can't compete with American farmers. So you take a basic commodity of corn that, according to the Carnegie Endowment report, the first 4 years of NAFTA had displaced over 3 million corn farmers. Well, those guys have to go somewhere. So the whole debate on NAFTA and how that they're going to reflect any immigration policies connected to it, particularly these guest worker programs and so on, I think is going to have a huge bearing on whether our people have a right to follow the same protocols that they're trying to launch through these trade agreements in terms of free trade and free markets. Well, the labor market is also a free market unless you allow the market to saturate itself by allowing migrants to travel freely, have the freedom of travel with proper documentation and proper labor rights. You're going to continue to see a great polarization of wealth and impoverishment of people in the countrysides.
Pete Dolak, let's turn to you. I want to stick with the same subject because it's frequently overlooked in the mass media presentations about NAFTA. And of course, Donald Trump says it's a terrible deal and it's hurting America and it's helping Mexico. In other words, just using stereotypical caricatured language so that nobody really understands what the issue is. But in the case of the corn growers, the farmers, the small farmers, especially the indigenous people in Mexico, they had their markets opened up to Western U.S. agribusiness, who, as Baldomar said, could come in and undersell, lower the price of corn, drive those indigenous farmers out of business. And then once they were out of business, they could raise the price of corn. And those people, those farmers had to go somewhere. So many of them migrated and they came to the United States or other places. And then they were targeted and demonized by the same forces, same political forces, as if they were some kind of criminal element, when what they're trying to do is feed their people, now their families. So, Pete, help us understand, is it bad? We know it's bad for indigenous farmers in Mexico. Was it bad for American workers in the United States as well?
I think it's been bad for workers in all three countries. As you just described the situation for Mexican farmers, it's been absolutely catastrophic for them. And the net result of all of this is displaced farmers either go into maquiladoras on the border or they go into the United States to find any job they can, because obviously you don't risk your life crossing a desert in 100 degree heat unless you're in a desperate situation. You're not doing it because you're a criminal or something like that, as the Trump forces always falsely portray these people. So as wages get driven down, then this is like a little thing that a U.S. manufacturer or a Canadian manufacturer can dangle in front of people. Says, well, all right, you know, you don't want to take a cut in pay. Okay, fine. We'll just cut you. We'll just shut you down and we'll reopen in Mexico. And they'll be happy to work for one-tenth of what you make. So, and it also makes it harder for the Mexican worker to raise their rates because everyone moves their production to Mexico precisely because of below wages. And as Mexican workers get more organized. And of course, they also have not only the government to contend with, but also the sham government-controlled unions there. But as they organize themselves and create their own unions and their own labor organizations and demand living or better wages, that same forces that drove production from the U.S. and from Canada into Mexico will now turn on them, and those manufacturers will say, oh, you want more money? Well, gee, too bad, because over in Bangladesh or in Vietnam or in China, they're going to work less than you are, and you're already starting to see some of that production in northern Mexico along the border is now already starting to move to countries with even lower wages. Now, Bangladesh and Vietnam have become the low-wage alternatives to China and also becoming the low-wage alternatives to Mexico as well. And this will keep getting repeated until, I guess, there's no more countries left.
Father Mar, it strikes me that Americans really either have forgotten or never knew the whole purpose of NAFTA. The purpose of NAFTA was that a rising tide raises all ships. And the point being that eventually wages are going to go up and Mexican workers are going to be able to earn more money to raise their families. They're going to have economic opportunities in Mexico. Then they're going to stay in Mexico. And then it's going to make immigration issues here in the United States less severe. It seems then that Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress are so short-sighted as to not see the benefits of a trade agreement like NAFTA. And I believe that killing it is just going to make the immigration problem in the United States even worse and put us in a worse position. Our policy, I think, should be to help the Mexican economy develop as much as it can. It's good for everybody. Would you agree?
I think you're addressing it the appropriate way. However, I think we have to understand that living in a global economy, we can't go back to the isolationism that we've had in the past, because global manufacturers with their global supply chains are going to figure out ways to circumvent any legal restrictions that are in their way. We live in a global economy, and so we have to globalize the rights of human beings and their ability to feed, educate, and clothe their families. And I think that any trade agreements that we have, and there eventually are going to be trade agreements, and they have to sort of reflect the realities of the consequences of decisions that are made in terms of commodities, but the migration of people should be treated like a market as well. It's a labor market, and what drives markets are supply and demand. And if you let the markets saturate themselves by allowing people to travel freely with their labor rights, if they have labor rights and the ability to form unions, the freedom of association, this is why we're challenging the global tobacco companies right now to implement freedom of association by implementing a practical mechanism on the ground outside government influence so that the workers can negotiate their own deals in their own countries. And if they migrate and do so freely with a travel visa that carries their labor rights, I know that seemed like a far-fetched idea, but it is the correct and the right thing to do and give people a chance to defend themselves. I think that's the bottom line.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's not far-fetched, because everything that we now have and take for granted in terms of labor rights, economic rights, civil rights, social rights, at one time, they all seemed like pie in the sky until they actually happened as a consequence of people's struggle. Pete Dolak, we have less than 2 minutes now. I think he's right. I think Baldemar is right. You can't stop global trade, but what needs to be promoted is global solidarity between workers in Mexico and Canada and the United States and all around the world, so that the labor movement and people, the working people who produce all of these goods, they have rights. And the thing about NAFTA, the way it was negotiated, the labor movements were completely excluded. They were not part of the process. Labor needs to be there. Working class people need to be at the table. Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. It's absolutely true. There will be trade. There will be international trade. The question is, well, trade to benefit who and on what basis? So the problem with this, with these corporate deals like NAFTA, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, like the proposed Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, et cetera, is that these are corporate trade deals. They're designed to give as many benefits to large capitalist inventors and designed to screw over working people in pursuit of endless profit. You know, the language for what benefits the corporations and trade always has words like must and shall. And they always have, you know, one little chapter in there that purports to do to defend labor rights or environmental rights, but the language there is always may or can. It's always provisional there. So when it goes to the arbitrator, who of course is a corporate lawyer and not an independent arbitrator in any normal sense, and as you would have in a normal legal situation, must and shall are always going to trump may and can, even before we get to the fact that they're corporate lawyers and their mindset is already biased toward corporate investment needs anyway. So we're going to have these deals and we are going to have trade, then we have to scrap NAFTA and we have to have a completely different concept of trade where it benefits working people.
Let's leave it right there. We're completely out of time. We've been joined from Chiapas, Mexico by Baldomar Velasquez. He is the president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, or FLOC, and we've been joined from New York by Pete Dalek. He's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro, who focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. And he's the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Lula da Silva is a giant in Brazilian politics, the former president and founder of the Workers' Party of Brazil. Is at a crossroads. He could finish this year in prison serving 9.5-year sentence for corruption or once again be the president of Brazil. We're joined from Sao Paulo by Valesca Teixeira Martins. She is President Lula's personal attorney. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us back.
Thank you. Valesca, I mean, of course, if Lula were to run, everyone expects that he would be elected again as the president of Brazil. He is by far the most well-known and the most popular politician, someone who rose from humble roots as a union organizer, became the founder of the Workers' Party of Brazil, and under his tenure, amazing reforms were implemented in Brazil, especially aimed at helping the poor, helping the working class, helping people who were disadvantaged in the past. But now here he is facing 9.5 years in prison, possibly. Talk about what the trial is about and if the trial is a legal matter or a political matter or both.
Well, it is our understanding that this is a political trial because of the lack of materiality of the charges. The charges don't have logic. They bring no evidence, no hard evidence. Not even a shred of evidence, I would say. And in spite of overwhelming evidence of innocence in this first trial, Judge Moro, who is also known to act as a prosecutor, convicted Lula would send him to jail for 9.5 years. Of course, we understand that this conviction is a politically motivated one. And after the sentence, which is curious, Brian, Judge Moro says in a motion to clarify, which is a motion used in Brazil when one needs to clarify an omission, an obscurity in one's decision, in a judge's decision. So we filed it after the sentence, the conviction sentence. And surprisingly enough, Moro stated, and it goes to the heart of the accusation, he stated that no one ever said, and he never said, that there was any money coming out of Petrobras, the oil national oil state oil company, that would result in an undue or illegal advantage to Lula. So that is basically the accusation of this procedure. He undermines and he throws away the entire accusation. And this apartment is also regarding a property of a beach apartment, which is registered under a construction company's name. It has been used in several financial operations, mortgage operations, debentures. It has been alienated to Caixa Econômica Federal, which is a bank of Brazil. Therefore, we have proven that Lula never had the property or possession of the apartment. He never spent one day in the apartment, never had the keys, never exercised possession. So we are highly confident that on Wednesday, Lula will be acquitted. Lula will be acquitted if an impartial and independent trial takes place. That is our hope.
That's of course, a big if. So help the our audience here in Washington, D.C. that may not be that familiar with the politics and the story as it's unfolded, and certainly won't be familiar with the legal processes in Brazil. Let's just help them understand what's going to actually happen. So in July 2017, Judge Moreau alleged that Lula was guilty of corruption and money laundering, resulting in a 10-year sentence. I believe that's correct. Now this verdict or this judge's ruling is being appealed. This is the appeals part of the trial. Just tell us what will happen and when.
Yes, Judge Moreau convicted Lula of having received what he alleges, a beach apartment in the state of São Paulo in return for favors to OAS in the Petrobras company, which is the state oil company. He says that he can, even though he may not identify an act of corruption on behalf of President Lula, that he doesn't have to. He even quotes six judgments from appellate courts from the United States, which have been overturned by the Supreme Court to base his decision on. And that is the sentence of conviction. We have appealed from that conviction sentence, and it is now on a record time going to be tried by the appellate court of Porto Alegre, which is the fourth region responsible for the jurisdiction of the car wash operation. That's what's going to happen on Wednesday.
So again, here Lula won two consecutive or maybe three consecutive presidential elections. I can't remember. Then Dilma took his place, ran again. Many people thought maybe she might lose, but she won. She won 52% of the vote. I believe that was in 2014. So the right-wing opposition, the opposition that has largely been backed by the United States, they lost election after election after election. Then they carried out what many people call a legislative coup d'etat against Dilma Rousseff on the grounds of corruption, even though, again, in the case of Dilma, no one is asserting, or no one with any credibility is asserting, that Dilma is personally corrupt whatsoever. And so then they were able to replace Dilma Rousseff with Michel Temer. And Temer's government is also rife with corruption. So you see the people who are really corrupt in Brazil charging Workers' Party officials with corruption in order to overturn what was, in essence, the majority vote of the electorate, which was for the Workers' Party. If Lula's case is not overturned, he will not be eligible to run for election in the upcoming presidential election. So using this process again, it would bar the Workers' Party from really fielding a slate that had a chance in the upcoming election. That's kind of what's going on, right?
Yes. Look, Lula and Dilma are victims of lawfare. Lawfare is the misuse and abuse of legal proceedings and the law for political and violence of the law for political means. It is an asymmetric attack. Therefore, as one knows, Lula is a victim of nine procedures. None of them have logic, evidence, even a shred of evidence. And this is what they do. They create false charges, just as Dilma and Dilma's process as well. False charges, frivolous charges. They occupy the enemy's time. They remove him from politics. withdraw them from their financial resources in order to demonize and delegitimize a political enemy. This is not only happening in Brazil, Brian. This is happening all over South America and in other parts of the world. This is a now known method. You don't have the army in the streets, but you do have the violence as well of the law. And this is now the new methodology used in order to overthrow a political enemy. Lula, even though they tried and they looked very hard into all of his bank accounts, they searched and seized their houses, his family houses, sent houses. They have not found one foreign bank account, one single act of corruption that they can blame Lula. And this has been a problem for them because we have overwhelmingly proved his innocence. And even though, in spite of any results on Wednesday, Lula will be a candidate, even if he is convicted, and then if he's convicted, it will be politically motivated. Even if he is convicted, he will run and he will be in the ballot box. They do not have the criminal court and the federal court does not have the authority of removing him from the race. That is a matter for the electoral justice in Brazil, which shall be discussed in due course of time. And we are absolutely certain that no court that's impartial, that's independent, will uphold the conviction decision.
Okay. And let me just ask you in our last minute or so, what's the mood in the street in Brazil about this? Because obviously, the Workers' Party and Lula in particular has vast support amongst the population and perhaps even more support than it did before Dilma was impeached and taken out through this legislative coup d'etat. What's the mood?
I mean, people have started to realize that the whole Carlos operation is not what it was supposed to mean. It's not about fighting corruption. It is about actually targeting Lula, the political chosen enemy, and going after him. I'll just describe it in numbers. For instance, 2 years ago, Judge Moro, who was responsible for the car wash operation, had a 90% rate of approval. Now he has 53% of disapproval rate. That will show you that the population is understanding what's happening. They do understand that the car wash operation is politically motivated and is not prosecuting Lula, but politically persecuting him.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Sao Paulo by Valesca Tashira Martins. She's President Lula's personal attorney. Valesca, thank you for joining. As this trial unfolds, as the appeals court unfolds, as the political process unfolds, because it's all intertangled, we hope you'll join us once again. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we begin a new weekly segment where we take a look at the economic direction of the country. And we're joined today, as we will each week, by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is in San Francisco and he's a financial policy analyst. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, I'm really interested in this Axios article that came out today saying that somebody in the White House has leaked the Trump infrastructure plan. What can you tell us about infrastructure and what the White House's intentions are?
The Trump administration campaigned on the idea that they would bring back a tremendous amount of jobs and productivity to the economy by rebuilding America's infrastructure, which frankly is desperately needed as much of our infrastructure is crumbling, is unsafe. I think only 1 out of 10 bridges passes safety inspections and the rest lack the funding needed to get rebuilt. So this is definitely something the country needs and it can provide jobs in an economy. So this was a big push on his part. The plan that was leaked by Axios, what's interesting is it's 6 pages long, which is, if you can imagine, for rebuilding America's infrastructure.
Right.
It's way too short. And contains no specific dollar amounts for any of the initiatives introduced.
No.
So it's a non-plan. It's almost a non-leak in the utter lack of information that's provided in it. and the utter lack of planning or thought that's gone into it by the Trump administration. And this was a major part of his platform, and frankly, even something that progressives could get behind. And it looks like there's really no plan to put any money into it or to address it in any significant way. And like many, you know, politicians on the road will kind of promise you the moon, and then when they get in office, you get something far less. It seems like that's the direction it's going in.
Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst, is our guest. This is part of a new weekly series on Loud and Clear, where we talk about some of the big stories regarding the U.S. economy. Of course, something that's on the minds of everyone who lives in the United States, especially poor people, working class folks, the middle class, and of course, the 1% or the 0.001%, the people who really have it all, also care about these issues, but from a completely different point of view. I'm looking at a story, Daniel Sankey. The headline is, New York Times, Walmart's bumpy days from wage increase to store closings. Paul Ryan has a tweet. Great news. Thanks to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Walmart's America's largest employer is raising wages, providing bonuses, and improving benefits for its workers. This law is helping improve people's lives. Now, of course, this law is the giveaway to the ultra, ultra rich. But Paul Ryan and the Republicans are saying no. It's also trickling down. Walmart has announced a wage increases. Talk about this story, Daniel Sankey.
So Walmart kind of capitalized on the passage of the Republican tax plan by at the same time providing bonuses to a large number of its employees, as well as extending maternity leave and some other benefits, and also raising their hourly minimum. So this was kind of a sort of publicity stunt to say, look, see, low taxes, and already you're starting to benefit. The reality is, of course, is that one of their major competitors, Target, had already increased its hourly wage to the same amount. I believe they were moving it to $11 an hour that Walmart was. And this was, in effect, to remain competitive with Target, who would snatch up workers out of the market. In addition, Walmart recently reported they're closing 102 Express stores and about 30 to 40 other stores, whether they're discount stores or supercenters or neighborhood markets. So they're closing more than 130 stores nationwide. And of course, this was planned well in advance. You're actually seeing a lot of other corporations do the same thing. AT&T said, oh, we're going to give all these bonuses to our workers. Look, the Republican tax plan's working. And then they're going to be laying off something like 10,000 workers over the next 3 years. So really, this is just kind of these wealthy corporations jumping on the propaganda campaign that these trickle-down works, when in fact, all they're doing is saving billions from the Republican tax plan, billions more by closing all these stores and passing out a couple of bucks to their workers to make it sound like they're great guys.
Daniel, CNBC is reporting that Andrew Staples, who's director of the Economist Intelligence Unit, said that he's saying that his firm expects the U.S. economy to slip into recession again in 2020, apparently just in time for the next presidential election. How do you square that with what really seems to be solid economic growth of whatever it is, 2.5% or more for the last two or three quarters? Do you see a recession coming?
It's certainly possible. And that's largely due to the fact that we've had such record low interest rates and unprecedented quantitative easing, you know, money going directly to the banks over the last decade or so, with really minimal effects. And for the first time, we're starting to see some degree of effects and some degree of us pulling out of the, you know, kind of destitution that 2008 and 2009 left us in. In response, the Treasury is probably going to raise interest rates about three times this year, because that's their way of signaling, oh, the economy can stand on its own. We don't need to resuscitate it. This is typical. Unfortunately, a lot of monetary policymakers do things like this, and it will have a cooling effect on the economy just as it's starting to pick its head a little bit, which then can lead to recession. It's not like, you know, some sort of colossal crash like in 2008, but it is, and I think Professor Steve Keen, who you've had on the show, says kind of a zombie economy where there's stagnation, minimal growth, minimal wage increase. I mean, there has been for a long time now as far as minimal wage increase is concerned. And I think that's a direction it'll go in when they start pushing those reforms. It'll also cause a huge popping of the stock market bubble, which has been buoyed up a lot by the money and those ridiculously low interest rates. So if they pursue that policy, and they probably will, I don't see why they won't, we will see it slipping into that.
Daniel Sankey, Donald Trump motivated, and the Republican Party motivated the tax plan, the tax giveaway to the already very, very rich and to corporate America on the basis that by lowering the corporate tax rate, American corporations would bring jobs back to the United States. They'd bring back enterprises, factories, brick and mortar. Now, I'm looking at a headline that says in the New York Times, tax law may send factories and jobs abroad, critics say. A construction site, there's a picture of workers in a Mexico construction site. A construction site in Mexico where Ford Motors has canceled plans for a factory for the biggest makers of cars and machines. Provisions of the new tax law could make it attractive for American companies to locate factories abroad. Now, Donald Trump was told a crowd in Missouri, factories will be pouring into this country. The tax cut will mean more companies moving to America, staying in America, and hiring American workers right here. This article says, according to the author and based on an assessment of the tax law, that it's written in such a way that there's actually an incentive for American companies to go abroad. Talk about that.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things the Republican tax plan did is it lowered the corporate tax rate in the United States to 21%, which is a huge cut. It also started taxing corporations who operated overseas, which is new. And at first, this sounds like a progressive thing, right? Because then they have to pay their fair share if they're U.S. corporations, right? But they're not. The tax overseas is going to be 10.5%. And if you do the math, that's exactly one half of what they're getting charged to the U.S. So while true, it's good to charge them overseas, they need to pay their fair share. If you're telling them overseas, you pay half of what you pay here, I mean, it's pretty simple calculation for corporations to say, okay, well, we'll pay more taxes, but we'll pay a heck of a lot less over there, which is what we'll probably see them continue to do. Furthermore, if they're going to move factories back here, given the expense of labor, they're going to spend a lot of that money they save on the tax plan on automation, on cheapening labor, because, of course, there's a lot of other hidden costs in terms of regulations and protection of workers here in the U.S. that also add to their costs and drain their profitability.
Might be called an America last tax policy.
Yeah, seriously. Americans don't know those details. They would rightfully be appalled if they knew.
Yeah, I want to go back to Walmart's. We only have about 90 seconds left, Daniel. Here we had Walmart's coming out and the Republicans crowing about the fact that Walmart is giving raises to some of its employees, increasing benefits, gave them a bonus. Within hours after that announcement, there was the leak that came out that 63 more of Sam Club stores are closing. 63. Now, the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, UFCW, which represents or is trying to represent Walmart's non-unionized workforce, they called the wage increases, quote, a public relations stunt, close quote, meant to distract from the closings. So here you have the Republicans scratching the back of the Walton family, who has the equivalent wealth of 46% of the American people. That's real. That's how much that family owns. They're closing hundreds of stores, or more than 100 stores. Thousands of workers will lose their jobs. But they and Trump and the Republicans can crow about the fact that they're really doing something great for the American worker. Go ahead. 1 minute left.
That's absolutely the case. And I think it's really frustrating that unfortunately people get taken in by that. And I think they see it and they see some sort of benefits going to Walmart workers and they're rightly excited. You have to be smart. These companies didn't become these massive global giants by passing out bonuses to their employees. They became it by pushing down and pressuring labor to be as cheap as possible, whether here or abroad. So if you see them passing out money, they're going to get something back for it. And in this case, they got kind of a PR campaign and kind of showed their loyalty to the current administration. So that's the reality of the situation, that when we see these benefits, we need to dig beneath the story and say, wait, why is this corporation doing this? What are they really getting out of this? Because I guarantee you they've thought this through.
Yeah, take off the rose-colored glasses.
That's right. Daniel, I'm sorry we're out of time. We were joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst, and he joined us today as part of a new weekly segment where we take a look at the economic direction of the country. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook.
You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.